Welcome to the second hour's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is the business and oil section. This column is entitled Energy Industry Searches Soul on Diversity Inclusion by Sergio Chapa, Houston Chronicle. The oil and natural gas industry is at a moment of reflection. On top of struggling to adapt to crude prices hovering under $40 a barrel and keeping its workforce safe from coronavirus pandemic, the industry is doing some soul searching on diversity and inclusion. The May 25th death of George Floyd, a black man, at the hands of Derek Chauvin, a white Minneapolis police officer, sparked national and international protests, and the oil and gas industry was not immune to the calls for social change. Civil rights leaders, including the Reverend Jesse Jackson and Mark Morial, president of the National Urban League, wrote letters to the industry trade group Interstate Natural Gas Association of America, asking for a meeting to discuss the hiring of more women and minorities. The population of the United States is 60% white, 18% Hispanic, 13% black, 6% Asian, and 3% other, according to the latest figures from the U.S. Census Bureau. But unemployment in the oil and natural gas industry does not reflect that. Of the 1.1 million people who work for the industry in the United States, about 75% are white and male. Data from the Energy Futures Initiative and National Association of State Energy Officials show. The industry has some catching up to do on race and gender, but the issue is already on the radar of some executives. In the days after Floyd's death, Lorenzo Simonelli, the Italian-born CEO of Baker Hughes, wrote a public letter stating that the Houston-based oilfield services company will not tolerate discrimination anywhere, without exception. Employing more than 67,000 people in 120 nations around the world, Baker Hughes has a multi-ethnic and multilingual workforce that Simonelli said values care and collaboration. We must do our part as a community and a company to stand together against this injustice, not only in the U.S., but around the world, Simonelli said. Parsley Energy President and CEO Matt Gallagher also wrote in a public letter that the Austin Oil Company is, quote, identifying local nonprofits that will support social equity and justice, unquote. Everyone must do their part, Gallagher said. It starts with each person being responsible for his or her own actions. But it cannot end there. Don't allow intolerance, even if you are a casual observer. Katie Maynard, CEO of the Houston-based industry social media platform Pink Petro, also wrote a public letter calling for change. Race, energy, and our environment are at a tipping point, Maynard said. To create change, we have to re-examine our own views and actions and must push aside the desire to be comfortable and to return to business as usual. To the black community, we see you and we hear you. You matter and your lives matter. But diversity and inclusion go beyond race. The industry still has hurdles when it comes to gender and LGBT issues. Sandra Saidman, a woman who once worked as a field engineer for oilfield services giant Schlumberger, sued her former employer for $100 million, claiming that she was forced to share sleeping quarters with a male co-worker who allegedly told others it would be okay for them to break into her bedroom and sexually assault her. Saidman alleged that the company does not protect women in the field and routinely dismisses a sexual harassment claim as just oil field talk or a joke. Company officials declined to comment, saying they have not been served with the lawsuit. Houston Liquefied Natural Gas Energy Company Chenier Energy recently debuted a rainbow-modified company logo in observance of Pride Month, an annual celebration to commemorate the June 1969 Stonewall Riots that sparked the gay rights movement in the United States. Chenier's Pride logo, however, is the exception rather than the rule. Observers believe the rainbow-covered logo is the first in the oil and natural gas industry, one that has a reputation of being blue-collar and conservative. Rice University anthropology professor Brian Riedel, an expert on LGBTQ issues, said, "Virtue signaling with a rainbow logo is easy to do on social media, but that actions speak louder than words." Don't pinkwash yourself with a logo. Actually take the time to relate to your employees and customers with the dignity they deserve, Riedel said. This article is entitled "Shell Expects Multi-Billion Write-Down in Second Quarter" by Laura Hurst from Bloomberg News. Royal Dutch Shell said it will write down $15 to $22 billion in the second quarter as the company gave investors a wide glimpse of just how severely the coronavirus has hit big oil. The pandemic left no part of the energy giant's sprawling business unscathed. Shell lost money from pumping oil, fuel sales fell, and shipments of everything from liquefied natural gas to petrochemicals suffered. The lockdown-induced slump has permeated through the entire industry, which is reassessing both the value of its assets and longer-term business models. Shell's large LNG business, which is central to its vision of the future energy, is seen taking the biggest hit. "We see material downside for second quarter earnings," Banco Santander SA analyst Jason Kennedy said. Despite a possible weaker performance relative to its peers, the Spanish bank still sees potential upside in the stock, as the bad news was largely anticipated. The drop in demand comes as little surprise. Oil majors' earnings took a beating in the first quarter, and the companies warned that things would only get worse as the full impact of the pandemic started to be felt in March. Despite a recent rebound in consumption in some of the worst-hit countries, resurgent waves of the virus show the recovery remains fragile. Oil product sales volumes will be 3.5 to 4.5 million barrels a day in the second quarter, down from 6.6 million a year earlier, driven by a significant drop in demand because of the pandemic, the oil major said Tuesday in a statement ahead of quarterly results on July 30th. Shell also flagged that its upstream unit, traditionally the company's core business, will suffer a loss in the second quarter. The division, which is responsible for pumping oil across the world, will take an impairment charge of $4 to $6 billion, mostly from North American shale and Brazilian assets. This article is entitled "Crude Posts Best Quarter Since 1990 After Historic Price Crash" by Haley Waller and Andrew Marcard, Bloomberg. Oil posted its best quarter in nearly 30 years, bouncing back from this year's historic price crash. The market's climb from negative territory in April has been swift but bumpy, with the U.S. benchmark struggling to hold above $40 a barrel amid a stubborn supply glut and a resurgence of COVID-19 cases that's darkened the demand outlook. But futures in New York surged 92% in the 3 months through June 30th, following crude's worst quarter on record, buoyed by OPEC plus production cuts and rebounding oil consumption in post-lockdown China. The West Texas Intermediate crude for August fell 43 cents to settle at $39.27 on Tuesday. It's not going to jump back up to $60 overnight, but to get where we are now from where we were is an incredible story, said Phil Flynn, analyst at Price Futures Group, Inc. How quickly the market can complete its recovery is an open question. Coming out of the rut will have to happen one day at a time, he said. While demand is gradually improving, it's still a long way off pre-crisis levels. In the U.S., a spike in virus cases is prompting many states to pause or reverse reopenings, which could curb summer travel just as fuel consumption was beginning to ramp up. Across the Atlantic, European Union governments extended a travel ban for U.S. residents. Rising American inventories are also weighing on prices, which are still down more than 30% so far this year. Crude stockpiles have expanded for the last 3 weeks to the highest level on record, while diesel supplies have swelled for 11 of the last 12 weeks. Government data released on Wednesday will reveal whether inventories are continuing to pile up. It could be a slaughter, said Robert Yauger, director of the Futures Division at Mizuho Securities USA. We could have three records tomorrow in gasoline, distillate, and crude oil at all-time record storage levels. And yet another threat to the market recovery, rising prices have prompted some U.S. producers to restart wells they shuttered after the crash. ConocoPhillips said Tuesday it will restore some curtailed production next month. While increasing U.S. output complicates OPEC Plus's goal of balancing the market, the Producer Alliance has made good on its historic pledge to cut production by almost 10 million barrels a day. Saudi Arabia and Russia have both slashed exports to multi-year lows, supporting physical prices in some parts of the world. This is the opinion page. This column is entitled, Trump Can't Decide How to Attack Biden, by Jonah Goldberg, Tribune News Service. If Donald Trump is going to defeat Joe Biden, he's going to have to define Joe Biden. It's not looking good right now. It's forgotten now, but there was a time when some of the crazier right-wing types thought President Dwight Eisenhower was a Soviet agent. The idea was popularized by the John Birch Society, which is a sort of a QAnon of its day. When asked about this nutty theory, Russell Kirk, a renowned conservative intellectual, famously responded, Ike's not a communist, he's a golfer. In fairness to Ike, he was also one of the most successful military leaders in world history, successfully overseeing the invasion of Europe and the defeat of Nazi Germany, among other resume highlights. But Kirk's quip captured the otherworldly likeness of the idea that President Eisenhower, who worked assiduously to fortify the NATO alliance against the Soviet Union, was really a pawn of Stalin. We're in a somewhat similar moment these days. The Trump campaign recently released an ad claiming that Joe Biden was endorsed by Osama bin Laden. Put aside the fact that bin Laden was unavailable for comment since he's dead for a while, killed on the orders of the Obama administration in which Biden served. The Trump campaign defense of the ad revolves around the fact that bin Laden apparently thought it would be good if Al-Qaeda could kill Obama, putting Biden in charge. But the endorsed by bin Laden silliness is part of a larger effort to paint Biden as a dangerous figure. Trump has called him a puppet of the radical left. He's been at pains to claim that Biden will be the poster boy for defunding the police and will grease the skids for America's descent into socialism. So far, Biden has been able to deflect much of this. At the beginning of the George Floyd protests, he rejected calls for defunding the police. In the primaries, he opposed Medicare for All and abolishing ICE. The Trump team's response has been to undercut its own messaging by also claiming that Biden is sleepy and boring and not really radical at all. You see the problem, right? Either he's a dangerous Jacobin or he's a low-energy, run-of-the-mill politician. Again and again, the Trump campaign smears Biden with mud on one hand and then cleans him off with the other. They claim he will be a Trojan horse for the Black Lives Matter movement and their defund the police agenda, and they denounce him for his record of putting more cops on the street. They attack him for working with segregationist senators while playing footsie with Confederate symbols. The Trump campaign thinks they can resolve this contradiction by arguing that he'll be a pushover for the radical left. On the merits, this is not as absurd a claim as they sometimes make it sound. Biden is a consummate go-along, get-along Democratic politician who never positioned himself as a centrist so much as a different splitter between liberal Democrats and more conservative ones. In other words, Biden's not a socialist. He's a hack. But as the polling indicates, he's a serviceable one because a boring, likable hack sounds pretty good now to a lot of people. Trump's problem is that he needs the votes from people who don't like him. Contrary to a lot of myth-making about the power of his base, Trump has always needed the voters who don't like him. The base got him close to the finish line in the Electoral College, not the popular vote in 2016. But the voters who put him over the top were those who disliked Hillary Clinton more than they disliked Trump. A late September 2016 Pew poll found that 11% of Trump voters would be disappointed if Trump won. Without those voters, Trump would have surely lost in 2016, and he needs them even more this time. He can lose a few points among his base. Who cares if he wins Alabama by 5 instead of 10? But he desperately needs Trump-exhausted former Trump voters in the suburbs of swing states, and he's losing them in droves. It's way too late to make those voters like Trump. There's theoretically time to convince them to fear Biden more than they fear Trump. But to do that, they need to come up with a disciplined message that Trump can deliver not at his base, but at the voters who will decide the election. And there's no sign they know how to do that. This column is distributed by Tribune Content Agency. This column is called Opinion Extra. It is entitled, MISD Deserves Credit for Efforts to Recruit, Retain Teachers, Staff, by editor Stuart Doreen. There was some confusion among those who read the story last week about Midland ISD teacher resignations and retirements. The first paragraph read, Midland ISD continues to be well behind last year's pace when it comes to resignations and retirements. The idea was that the district, for the second straight month, did not have as many resignations or retirements year over year. There wasn't as many during that particular month, and there were less overall. Woodrow Bailey, chief of human capital management for the district, later told the Midland Reporter-Telegram, resignations and retirements are down 40%. That was much clearer. Thank you, Mr. Bailey. No matter how one says or writes it, it appears as if MISD will enjoy a banner year for keeping employees. The number of resignations and retirements had dropped from 491 in 2017-18 to 444 last year, and the district reported 179 from March through June on its monthly reports. Again, no matter how one says it or writes it, that is likely to be an improvement, and we will take it. A school district in need of academic stability needs less turnover, and it appears our community may get it. Is it because of higher salaries, technology bonuses, the percentage that the district pays into health insurance, or something else? No one can say for sure. Maybe it is that the economy is such a tough slog that staying in one's job is the best option. That happens in our cyclical economy, just like the $1,600 average apartment rent when the economy is blowing and going. Still, Midland ISD deserves credit for a human capital recovery. What I also noticed in reading this month's agenda packet was that the number of teachers approved by the board in June, 85, was nearly double the number last year, 46. Again, kudos to the district for improvement on this front. Let's see. Fewer people are leaving and more people are coming. Those are the types of trends that are meaningful. We need more trained teachers in front of our children. I have said this previously, but it bears repeating. If the district had been dealt a better hand, it must now take advantage of that. The culture should provide opportunities for professional growth. The atmosphere should inspire teachers to their best work. The support should show teachers they are not alone. Culture, atmosphere, and support are part of a recipe for greater academic performance, and there are many Midlanders interested in seeing that improvement. Thank you to those in the district who have worked to improve retention inside Midland ISD. Your work is appreciated. Thank you also to those in the community who are committed to helping the district create a better culture, improve the atmosphere for learning, and providing support for teachers. We need you now more than ever. It appears our retention and recruitment efforts have improved. Now comes the hard part, doing it again. This column is entitled, Shame is Tool to Fight Pandemic, by Kathleen Parker, Washington Post Writers Group. Columbia, South Carolina. City and state officials here, frustrated by locals who dare not don a mask despite the state's inglorious designation as a coronavirus hotspot, are dusting off an old standard, shame. Leave it to South Carolinians to ignore warnings and urgent suggestions that wearing a mask and physically distancing can drastically reduce the rate of infection. This is Trump country after all. If the president eschews the mask, why should his comrades in obstinacy surrender to trendiness? Secession in certain quarters wasn't just a passing fancy, but is an attitude that persists no matter the century. Federal dictates or even recommendations for your own good are viewed with suspicion. And then there are strict constitutionalists, such as Governor Henry McMaster, for whom my son works, who believe government shouldn't dictate people's behavior, but rather should encourage their better angels. The governor reluctantly ordered non-essential businesses and beaches closed for a couple of weeks starting at the end of March. But it has never imposed a strict stay-at-home order as other states have. In part, this was because South Carolina didn't have as many cases relative to its population as other states, and a surge wasn't expected to hit until late May or early June. With the predictability of hurricane season, the surge came, and most sensible people have begun to get nervous. Yet with few exceptions, businesses and restaurants remain open, if with self-imposed restrictions and fewer customers. Wearing a mask, says McMaster, is a matter of personal responsibility, which should and may be true in some cases, but not in our little insane asylum. Speaking of the devil, South Carolina is also home to a not small number of religious charismatics who believe that the wearing of masks is Satan's handiwork, designed to block the breath of God. Why, there's talk that even the Episcopalians are passing around snakes these days. But seriously, how can officials fight a highly contagious and sometimes deadly disease against such stubborn resistance? Fortunately, the Bible's authors thought of that too. Shame. Though largely banished from the public square decades ago, shame is making a comeback, not just here, but in the broader culture. The death of George Floyd while in police custody was finally enough to shame enough white Americans into acknowledging that Black Lives Matter and that the burden of setting things right is the majority population's to bear. Week after week, we see the remnants of slavery, Jim Crow, and the Confederacy being toppled, removed, or abandoned, right down to the Dixie in the now renamed the Chicks. Wearing a mask may seem a minor issue compared to systemic racism or police brutality, unless, that is, you happen to be one of the more than 120,000 Americans already felled by the disease. But it's all part of the same zeitgeist of community, with an emphasis on shared sacrifice and unity. Besides, businesses are getting on board, which can change everything. In the capitalist commune, virtue becomes an incentive, and only the morally fit businesses survive. If shaming the smokers conquered big tobacco, could shaming the mask deniers tame the pandemic? Greenville, a vibrant city in the western half of the state, decided to find out. Together with the Greenville County Government, the Greenville Chamber of Commerce, and other business entities, the city recently launched the Greater Greenville Pledge, by which retailers, restaurants, and other businesses declare their adherence to state and federal guidelines for social distancing, sanitizing, capacity, and employee health monitoring. Once a pledge is made, businesses can download a marketing package that includes signs for windows and counters. Customers who don't see a pledge sign may well go elsewhere, the thinking goes. McMaster liked the idea so much, he decided to duplicate the effort statewide, but only for restaurants. Called Palmetto Priority, the state program encourages residents to complete a lengthy checklist of reopening guidelines and to participate in both a required online education program and health department food safety inspection. Upon completing the checklist and signing a commitment to employees and customers, restaurants would receive a program endorsement and a sticker for their window. The program also includes an online form for patrons to evaluate restaurant standards. Sound good? Absolutely not. Did I mention this is South Carolina? Already, some restaurant owners are upset that under the program, they'd essentially be regulated twice over and subject to the whims of angry customers. But aren't customers always, aren't restaurants always subject to critical reviews of Yelp and TripAdvisor? The only difference now is diners would prefer sanitizer in their finger bowls. Besides, it's all voluntary, which would please advocates of personal responsibility, as well as restaurateurs committed to surviving the pandemic. In the new economy of shame, the good guys wear masks.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Odessa American for Sunday, June 28th, 2020. Opinion. Insults to Black history. Many whites are ashamed, saddened, and feel guilty about our history of slavery, Jim Crow, and gross racial discrimination. Many black people remain angry over the injustices of the past and what they see as the injustices of the present. Both blacks and whites can benefit from a better appreciation of black history. Often overlooked or ignored is the fact that, as a group, black Americans have made the greatest gains over some of the highest hurdles and in a shorter span of time than any other racial group in history. For example, if one totaled up the earnings and spending of black Americans and considered us as a separate nation with our own gross domestic product, we would rank well within the top 20 richest nations. A black American, General Colin Powell, once headed the world's mightiest military. Black Americans are among the world's most famous personalities, and a few black Americans are among the world's richest people, such as investor Robert F. Smith, IT service provider David Stewart, Oprah Winfrey, and basketball star Michael Jordan. Plus, there was a black U.S. president. The significance of these achievements cannot be overstated. When the Civil War ended, neither a slave nor a slave owner would have believed such progress would be possible in less than a century and a half, if ever. As such, it speaks to the intestinal fortitude of a people. Just as important, it speaks to the greatness of a nation in which such gains were possible. Nowhere else on earth could such progress have been achieved except in the United States of America. The issue that confronts us is how these gains can be extended to about one quarter of the black population for whom they have proven elusive. The first step is to acknowledge that the civil rights struggle is over and won. At one time, black Americans did not enjoy the constitutional guarantees as everyone else. Now, we do. While no one can deny the existence of residual racial discrimination is not the major problem confronting a large segment of the black community. A major problem is that some public and private policies reward dependency and irresponsibility. Chief among these policies is the welfare state that has fostered a 75% rate of out-of-wedlock births and decimated the black family that had survived Jim Crow and racism. Keep in mind that in 1940, the black illegitimacy rate was 11%, and most black children were raised in two-parent families. Most poverty, about 25%, is found in female-headed households. The poverty rate among husband and wife black families has been in the single digits for more than two decades. Black people can be thankful that double standards and public and private policies rewarding inferiority and irresponsibility were not a part of the 1920s, 30s, 40s, and 50s. If there were, then there would not have been the kind of intellectual excellence and spiritual courage that created the world's most successful civil rights movement. From the late 1800s to 1950, some black schools were models of academic achievement. Black students at Washington's Dunbar High School often outscored white students as early as 1899. Schools such as Frederick Douglass, Baltimore, Booker T. Washington, Atlanta, P.S. 91, Brooklyn, McDonough, 35, New Orleans, and others operated at a similar level of excellence. Self-destructive behavior has become acceptable, particularly that in predominantly black schools, is nothing less than a gross betrayal of a struggle, paid with blood, sweat, and tears by previous generations, to make possible today's educational opportunities that are being routinely squandered. I guarantee that whites who lived through that struggle and are no longer with us would not have believed such a betrayal possible. Government should do its job of protecting constitutional rights. After that, black people should be simply left alone, as opposed to being smothered by the paternalism inspired by white guilt. On that note, I just cannot resist the temptation to refer readers to my Proclamation of Amnesty and Pardon, which grants Americans of European ancestry amnesty and pardon for their own grievances and those of their forebears against my people, so that they stop feeling guilty and stop acting like fools in their relationship with Americans of African ancestry. Walter Williams. Williams is an economics professor at George Mason University and is also a syndicated columnist. National View. Supreme Court makes it clear Congress must fix DACA. The Point. Majority of Americans believe the government should leave the Dreamers alone and craft a path to citizenship. A significantly fractured Supreme Court recently shot down the Trump administration's efforts to undo the Obama-era Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, concluding, without ruling on the merits of the policy itself, that the government's order canceling DACA was arbitrary and capricious. But the president's efforts also were cold, heartless, and counter to the nation's best interests, so it's encouraging that the court allowed the program to continue. But DACA survived on a technicality. Had the administration taken the time to lay a proper foundation for its impulsive action to withdraw the protections for the Dreamers, this decision could have gone the other way. So, as heartening as the court's decision might be, it does not resolve the underlying issue. DACA is, at best, a temporary solution to a broader problem, and it's one of the more frustrating aspects of our long-running political impasse over immigration reform. Reasonable minds, and a majority of Americans, regardless of political affiliation, recognize that the Dreamers stand in a unique position, not of their own creation, and justice and fairness dictate that they receive some accommodation. Yet DACA, which is a policy decision that is demonstrably susceptible to political vagaries, doesn't do that. It just delays the crafting of a real solution. The Obama administration crafted DACA in 2012 after a bipartisan proposal in Congress was scuttled by the deep partisan divisions on immigration policy. It provides temporary protections against deportation for people who meet specific criteria based on their arrival and length of residence in the United States, who have led productive lives through jobs or schooling, and who have not had significant run-ins with the law. Most of the Dreamers bear little responsibility for their presence here, since they were brought as minor children by parents or guardians. It would be manifestly unfair, as the anti-DACA folks demand, to uproot them from the only country most of them have ever really known, and send them off to places that are not only foreign to them, but where in many instances they don't speak the language. The hardships such deportations would create on people who are Americans in all but legal standing, far outweighs any purported gain in hardline enforcement of immigration laws. There are other pragmatic reasons for finding a better solution to this problem. Those who qualify for DACA include parents of about 250,000 children born here in the U.S. What purpose is served in disrupting those families, or even worse, forcing parents to leave the country with children who are U.S. citizens? What sense does it make to force American children to pay a penalty for the long-ago misdeeds of their grandparents? Further, the DACA-eligible folks have been educated here by U.S. taxpayers, contribute to the economy, and play significant roles in their communities. The Center for American Progress estimates that more than 200,000 DACA recipients are essential workers, including first responders, frontline healthcare workers, and food producers and distributors during the coronavirus pandemic. The nation should reward them by kicking them out? The solution here is clear. An overwhelming majority of Americans, including Republicans, believe the government should leave the Dreamers alone and craft a path to citizenship. That can only be done by Congress. President Trump has been an unreliable figure on this issue, saying at one point that he would support legislation to help the Dreamers, but then holding the issue hostage to his own dreams for a border wall with Mexico. Whether Trump would do the right thing now, as he campaigns for re-election, is anyone's guess, but Congress should make the effort and force the issue. And if Trump successfully vetoes it, the nation can hope that the next president could fix it come January. At a base level, it's troubling and dysfunctional that a relative handful of xenophobes among Trump's base can in effect block a sensible humanitarian act supported by the vast majority of their fellow citizens. That is the antithesis of a healthy democracy. And in this instance, it has a drastic impact on the lives of people caught up in circumstances created by others. Congress needs to get its act together and take an obvious step in the national interest. The Los Angeles Times.
Hello, this is April reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Sunday, June 28, 2020. Viewpoints. Abbott stepped in because people didn't take responsibility. By Stuart Doreen. S. Doreen at HurstNP.com. The coronavirus conversation has taken many turns during the pandemic. But sadly, the conversation typically has little to do with how to overcome the virus. I wish it would. It seems like we are so busy insisting we are right about a coronavirus-related issue that we have missed the entire point. It is hard to get a read on whether people are that concerned about the virus going away, and I can add my name to that list. I have, since the beginning of the pandemic, fully supported our governor in his handling of the pandemic. Governor Greg Abbott was right to take the steps he did early on, and was right to start loosening the reins and opening up the economy. However, like Abbott, I assumed the average Texan was as concerned about keeping the curve flat. That wasn't the case. Many of us were guilty, and now it is time to pay the price. More restrictions. Is it fair? Absolutely not. Do I think bars should be closed? No way. Are we to blame for the spike in coronavirus cases, the number of hospitalizations, and increased death count? Afraid so. Blame the governor all you want. He didn't force people into gatherings when we all know signs said to take precautions, practice social distancing, and wear masks. The governor didn't call on you to take part in a protest or Memorial Day festivities, or even go to your neighborhood HEB without concern for yourself, your neighbor, or fellow Texans. I tried to wear my mask, but I know there were times I was not as diligent as I should have been. Fast forward to last week. There has been a dramatic 180-degree turn taken in the community and state. It also is a clue that this is serious again. One day we are concerned about plans for reopening school, And the next, we are curious about who brought coronavirus into a school board meeting. Quick aside, is anyone else a little concerned that teachers are to report in about 40 days? That is the reality we face, and we haven't hit July 4th. Some of you want to make this a partisan issue, but we know it isn't. Republicans and Democrats are equally complicit. I have seen conservatives and liberals put on a mask, just like I have seen those on the political left and right go without. For those wanting to throw stones, there are plenty of examples of leaders from both parties across the nation not living to a high enough standard in the gatherings they approve and the ones they condemn. This is about personal responsibility. Always has been. This is about the people and not government being in control of flattening the curve. Always has been. This is about doing what we know is right, so we don't make it worse in the fall when students have to go back to school. At least that was my hope. And now this is about government leaders stepping in and taking steps they deem necessary because we didn't do our job. It used to be that I hoped college football could be played on Saturday afternoons in the fall. This week was a clear indicator we aren't there yet, not even close. I know it, you know it, and most importantly, Governor Abbott is clearly aware of it. He hit the reset button on Friday and probably sounded the death knell for many in the bar business and others in the restaurant industry. Yes, there must be a better way, but without a guarantee that all Texans will participate, no one can say with absolute certainty that their solution is better. No one. Rename Lee to Focus on Midland's Uniqueness by Ryan J. Pays. Reported Telegram contributor. The debate on whether to change the name of Lee High School or not has certainly gotten heated. I went to Midland High School, class of 2009, so I don't have many ties to Lee. I believe that gives me some objectivity to the debate. I say let's change the name of the school. I'm not advocating for change because I think the name is racist. I also want to point out it is not erasing history either. You are still a rebel, class of 19-whatever. Just like if they want to change the name again in the future, the people who went to the school now and until said change will still be, insert mascot here, class of 20-whatever. What's my reasoning for changing the name then? This city, area, is one of the most unique places to live, work, and grow. Why not be more creative? Why not rename it to someone with strong ties to Midland? In 2019, multiple sources listed right around 100 schools across the nation with the name Robert E. Lee. The one in San Antonio tried to be creative with just calling it Lee, which stands for Legacy of Educational Excellence. From a taxpayer standpoint, keeping the Lee and dropping the Robert E. makes fiscal sense when it comes to rebranding. I'm willing to meet halfway and accept this sort of creativity. However, I want us to get our brains together and come up with something special. Recently, we had two iconic Midland oil men pass away. I believe it'd be an honor to name the school J.L. Davis High. There are other Midlanders, both living and deceased, that could be in consideration too. If it's someone in the oil business, we need a creative mascot as well. We've seen drillers and roughnecks used, but I'm sure with some brainstorming, we could come up with something original. I also know it's a little ironic that this is coming from a bulldog. Mascot names do tend to be repetitive. Just look at this year's college football championship, in which we saw Tigers versus Tigers. Sure, I would be okay with changing the mascot there, too. I will finish this piece with a disclaimer. My primary focus is not on this potential name change. The primary focus will, and always will be, on the education. We need curriculum reform. Some ways to do that are to loosen the state regulations, eliminate standardized testing, and actually be independent districts. We need financial reform, like the elimination of Robin Hood, and more. I'm well aware of these issues. I decided to express my thoughts about the name change since we've probably all have seen the name change petition circulating online by now. My hope is that maybe we can come together as residents and brainstorm together a school name and potential mascot that is unique to this special city. One that when an outsider hears it, they know exactly where we are from. Good old Midland, Texas.
Hi, This is Jack. I'm reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Sunday, June 28, 2020. Letters to the Editor. MCPL has fake opening. Many people use the computers at the local libraries to print because they don't own a printer, and it's cheaper than going to FedEx. So imagine my surprise when I attempted to print from the computer and was told, due to the coronavirus, there is no printing. This is where the fake opening comes in. This is being done to curb folks from coming in. I was told I would need to go to FedEx and print off my phone. You can now go to the bar and eat at a restaurant, but you can't print at any of the libraries. Shame on you. Stephen Harris. Name school after someone else named Lee. While I personally do not see a need to change the name of Robert E. Lee High School, based not on his war record but on his educational leadership as president of Washington College, now Washington and Lee University, nevertheless, it is true that as a slave owner and political leader, he was not in favor of equal rights. Changing the name of the school would involve more than just a cosmetic renaming, since the name Lee is pretty much set in stone or linoleum throughout the school. I would like to suggest a compromise that won't involve jackhammers. Change the person and the mascot, but leave the name Lee intact. In pursuit of that idea, I've compiled a list of 16 people surnamed Lee who would be worthy of being the namesake of a school. The list includes military leaders, Medal of Honor recipients, political leaders, and some artists. I have submitted the entire list to the school board, but include a short list below. Personally, I believe George Washington Lee, a black author and Republican political leader, would be a choice all could agree on. However, I also think the students would not object to renaming the school after Stan Lee of Marvel Comics fame. Amy Freeman Lee, artist, writer, lecturer. George Washington Lee, black author, political leader. Hubert L. Lee, Medal of Honor recipient. Sheila Jackson Lee, Texas politician, black woman. Stan Lee, Marvel Comics. William C. Lee, general, father of the U.S. Airborne Screaming Eagles. And Willis Augustus Lee, admiral, commanding ships at Guadalcanal, the Olympian. Signed, Mark McDonald. Vote for Proposition A to offset funding cuts. On July 14th, Midlanders will be faced with an important sales tax election regarding medical care. But what will a 0.25% sales tax cost me? I'll spend an extra 25 cents on every $100 purchase. Let's see. A Whataburger might cost me an extra penny, a restaurant dinner an extra 20 cents, and a big screen TV an extra $1.50. I won't spend any extra money on medication or groceries if this sales tax passes. Now, how will this 0.25% sales tax benefit me? It will help Midland Health continue to recruit more physicians. We really need another neurologist. Help fund medical residents through our partnership with Texas Tech University Health Science Center, and compensate on-call specialty physicians. There will also be support for primary care providers for treating uninsured and underinsured patients as Medicaid rolls diminish. I realize it's hard to see past the current medical crisis, but future cuts in federal aid will be just as depleting if we do not act now. I encourage you to vote for Proposition A. At least with this election, all shoppers in Midland will help contribute, not just property owners. Signed, John W. Foster, Jr. Vote for Prop A to continue services. My family and I are longtime supporters of Midland Health, and were actively involved in the campaign for tomorrow that funded our state-of-the-art Scarborough patient tower. Living and working in Midland for many years, we have seen our local health system grow and improve dramatically, and our community's health care needs are better served than ever before. I have generally enjoyed very good health, but very recently I had an emergency visit and a short stay in the hospital, but I could not have been more pleased with the care and service I received. Midland County Hospital District has proposed a 0.25% sales tax to replace lost federal funding and assure its ability to continue supporting the community health services we all depend on. I'm voting yes for Proposition A. For more details, visit sayyestohealthcare.com. Carol Warren. Vote yes to thank Midland Health. Over the past several years, Healthcare Midland has made great strides, inspired by community leaders and supported by generous individuals, businesses, and foundations, and $38 million a year from the U.S. government. Now, that $38 million will start disappearing. And then what? When my wife, Alethea, and I moved here in 1992, healthcare was adequate, but not nearly as good as it was in the Detroit area where we had lived. We were relatively young, so it was okay, until suddenly it wasn't. A crisis struck, was resolved, but required long-term management from a team of doctors. That worked, until some of the doctors moved or retired. Replacing them took a long time, but it finally happened with the leadership of Midland Health and some of that government money. The new team helped improve health, and for that we are grateful to the doctors and to Dew and to Midland Health. One way for us to say thanks and help assure quality health care for more of our neighbors is to vote yes for Proposition A and ask everyone to do the same. Because voting yes proves Midlanders will take care of their own. Jim Blischke. The opinion page. Here's an opinion extra by Rich Lowry, King Features Syndicate. Presidential election will be ugly no matter who wins. President Donald Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden agree on one thing. The other side is trying to steal the election. Trump told a gathering of students in Phoenix that this will be, in my opinion, the most corrupt election in the history of our country. He amplified the point, a constant theme of his, in a tweet. Rigged 2020 election. Millions of mail-in ballots will be printed by foreign countries and others. It will be the scandal of our times. The President of the United States, actively undermining faith in the electoral process, is gross and unprecedented. But he's not alone. Asked by Trevor Noah of The Daily Show whether he worried the election would be rendered moot by his supporters being prevented from voting, Biden replied, "It's my greatest concern, my single greatest concern. This president is going to try to steal this election." This wasn't an isolated comment. "Mark my words," he said, "in May, I think he's going to try to kick back the election somehow. Come up with some rationale why it can't be held." Yes, if there's one thing everyone can now agree on, it's our inability to pull off a free and fair election. We are probably headed to the ugliest electoral smash-up since 1876, when the contest between Republican Rutherford B. Hayes and Democrat Samuel Tilden went into overtime, with each party claiming it had won Florida, Louisiana, and South Carolina. Perhaps a handy victory by Biden or, much less likely, Trump will take the edge off the post-game acrimony, but it is going to be ugly regardless. If the election is close, the aftermath will be a norm-busting extravaganza of conspiracy theories, lawsuits, and, at the very least, threats to take it to the streets. If Trump loses, there's unlikely to be a concession phone call, one of the little grace notes of our democracy, and he will argue that he was undone by Democratic cheating. Heck, he won in 2016 and still maintained he had been cheated. The transition would surely be unlike any we've ever seen, with the incumbent routinely insulting his soon-to-be successor. Trump would likelier to live-tweet Biden's inauguration than to attend, and if he wins, it could be even worse. There were protests in the streets after he won in 2016. in the supercharged atmosphere of 2020, we shouldn't be surprised by riots. After once again believing he'd inevitably lose and facing another intolerable 4 years of President Trump, the left's shock and despair would be unlike anything either side in our politics has experienced in memory. It's not going to lead Trump's opposition to conclude, "Oh, well, we ran another flawed candidate and got overconfident again. We'll retool and see in 2022 and 2024. One of the ironies of the 2016 election is that Democrats rightly scolded Trump for preparing the ground not to accept the election result. Then, when he won, they resisted accepting the result themselves, preferring to believe that the election had been stolen by Russia. A close result will obviously magnify feelings on both sides. The Florida vote controversy of 2000 was the height of recent domestic contention over a presidential election. Looking back, though, it was remarkably tame. With control of the presidency hanging by a thread in Florida, there was no large-scale demonstrations, let alone violence. The legal briefs flew fast and furious, and both former President George W. Bush and former Vice President Al Gore wanted to win and distrusted the legal and electoral maneuvers of the other side. Yet there were things that neither of them would say in public, and both of them were willing, if it came to that, to concede with grace. Both men were shaped by the post-World War II consensus in American politics. They had absorbed its standards and reflexively honored its guardrails. That was 20 years and an eon ago.
Hello, this is Michael reading from the Odessa American, Wednesday, July 1st, 2020. Squeaky hip joint likely aggravating, but not dangerous. To Your Good Health by Dr. Keith Roach. Dear Dr. Roach, I'm 69 years old, I take no medications, and I'm in very good health. 15 years ago, I had a hip replacement, and now it is starting to squeak when I walk. It is a ceramic socket and a titanium ball. Is there any kind of cream I can rub on my hip or an injection I could get to lubricate the joint? When will I know that I absolutely have to get my hip replaced? Unfortunately, there is no cream that you can rub on that can get into the prosthetic joint, and no lubricant that can be injected will stay in long enough to effectively treat the squeak. The main goal in evaluation of the joint is to determine whether there is damage to the prosthesis, the replacement hip. This requires a history and exam, imaging studies, and possibly blood tests or testing of joint fluid. If the joint is still in good shape, 90% still are even after 15 years, and you are moving well and not in pain, then nothing needs to be done. I would strongly advise against surgical revision of the joint unless there is a clear reason to do so. The presence of symptoms, especially pain, is the primary reason to do a surgical revision of the hip, which is generally a more difficult surgery than the initial replacement. Attraction to bartender causes town tongues to wag. Dear Abby, my husband of 43 years, an alcoholic, has started going to the local grill bar in our small town. He spends 3 to 4 hours there, 6 days a week. He would go in more often if they were open on Sundays. People who know us tell me things that have been going on between a single bartender and him. This bartender has given him gifts, and I heard that he overtips her. I have also been told there's more going on than the outward flirting, and my husband has been saying some very bad things about me. The bartender is not a young woman, and she tells anyone who will listen that she's looking for a man. I have asked my husband nicely to stop going there, and he does for a few days, until her calls and posts on Facebook start about me, keeping him from going to the bar. When he gets home, he continues drinking until he passes out. I have told him that if he gets a DUI and goes to jail, I won't bail him out. He really doesn't care. And I don't know what to do. Help. Disaster in Georgia. Dear Disaster, your signature is correct. Your marriage is a disaster. As long as your husband continues to drink, nothing will improve. keep uppermost in your mind that as much as you want to, you cannot change him. Contact a divorce lawyer and find out what you need to do to protect yourself financially. And join an Al-Anon group. There may be more than one near you. When you do, you may find not only some much-needed emotional support, but also perspective. I am sorry for what you are experiencing, but once you attend a meeting, you will find out you are not alone and that there is a way out. Dear Abby, I am a single 30-year-old female who is child-free. I never wanted kids, ever. My personal stance and views on the subject are well known to my coworkers, all of whom have children. I share an office with Elise, who's about 18 years older than I am. Over the years, she has made remarks such as, "You have no right to be tired, you don't have kids," or, "You don't count because you don't have kids," or, "You're not a real adult because you don't have the responsibility of having kids," my favorite. How do I deal with her, or what do I say to counter her remarks? When she makes them, it hurts my feelings. I don't react because I know if I do, it will hurt her feelings and cause friction in the office, which I don't need. But I'm sick to death of people like her who have children saying those things about people like me. Free forever. Dear Free, your coworker appears to be voicing her frustrations about the responsibilities of parenthood and somewhat jealous that you are free of them. The next time she hurts your feelings, it would not be overreacting to tell her that she has and ask her for an apology. If she's doing it hoping to get a rise out of you, ignore her. But if it persists, as a last resort, talk to your boss or human resources about it, because she's creating a hostile work environment. It's the truth. She should be talking with you about work, not her personal opinions about you.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.